This is Ruth Weiner, along with my colleague, Mildred Menlo. This is our second interview with Mr. William Block for the Oral History 2 Project, National Council of Jewish Women. Mr. Block, in looking through the notes, I see that we didn't get the name of Grandmother Block. Do you know what her name was?
My grandmother?
Yes, on the Block side.
On the Block side. No, I don't.
Are there any stories about her, any recollections about her?
I heard very little about her. And I don't know. And the only person who would have been able to shed some light on this, I'm afraid, died about a year ago. That was a cousin of mine who was the daughter of my father's older brother. And she died last spring. In fact, I went up to the hospital and was there a day before she died. I don't know very much about, and my father apparently didn't talk very much about that, or at least I don't remember.
Yes. You did talk about your Aunt Molly, who was a favorite aunt of yours.
When I was growing up in New York, she was taking care of my grandfather. So my grandmother had been dead for some time, and she was taking care of my grandfather. And then he died, I guess, when I was very young, because I only have a very vague memory of that. So I was very young of knowing him. And then, of course, Molly lived on, and I...
What was her last name?
Block.
Oh, she was all right. I didn't know where she fit in with the family.
Oh, yeah, she was my... father's, I think, older sister.
Oh, I see, and unmarried then. So,
yes, she never married.
Can you tell us something about her attitude toward Judaism, her affiliations? Was she a member of the temple also?
I don't know that. Mm-hmm. I don't know her.
And
whether she had any specific affiliation.
Can you tell something about, in that light, about the grandparents Wallach, Carl and...
Carl was dead when I was born. Mm-hmm. And all I knew about him was that he had two wives who died in childbirth. And each time, as I understood it, he went back to Germany and brought back a new bride.
That's
so that there was a family of nine, and if I'm not mistaken, and my mother's mother had three children, and died in childbirth with the third one, who lived on.
So you never had a chance to know her.
I think there were two with the first wife, and then there were five, I think. I'm a little hazy on it, but there were, if I'm not mistaken, there was a total of nine offspring by three wives.
Did you have family get-togethers with all of these aunts and uncles?
Mostly with the specific ones that were in the segment of one mother. In other words, my mother was very close to her sister Belle, and they were sisters, their mother was the same mother, and I don't think, and yes, my mother was fairly quite close to a sister, really a stepsister, Esther, who was older and by the first wife.
Did any of these people have an affiliation with things that were Jewish?
Oh, I think so. I think Esther did. But I'm not too familiar with what they, you know, what
that wasn't part of your.
I'm not too familiar with, because I was pretty young while those people were around. And then you see, before long, I went away to school, and I sort of lost track of those relatives. And then I went to work in Toledo and here in Pittsburgh, and then the Army and so forth. And I rarely saw any of them. I mean, I was not really a part of that situation at all. So I've stayed fairly close to the children of Bell, who died before my mother did, and her children, Peter, who was a few months older than I, Alan, who was a little bit younger than I, maybe three years, something like that. And then they had a sister, Marjorie, who died quite young. She married a Brazilian and lived in São Paulo for quite a while. And I guess that life didn't agree with her too well. She couldn't handle it too well. She had a lot of problems. And then on my father's side, I've stayed quite close to an adopted son of his younger sister, Blanche, my father's younger sister, Blanche. Married a man named Gerson Livewright. He was, I think, originally from Philadelphia. And their adopted son, Peter, lives in Maryland now and has had a very nice family. And I see him once in a while. We keep in touch, but that's about the sum of the substance of my relationship with relatives. I suppose I've been closest to Alan Gage, who was Bell's son, my cousin.
Talking about what really is the history of the newspaper, you talked about the Givens estate. And in reading it over, who was Mr. Givens? What was the Givens estate?
I don't
estate?
Know anything about that, and I've never researched it. So I'm not. All I know is that Mr. Braun, Arthur Braun, who was the head of Farmers Bank, which later became part of Union Trust and the Mellon, and merged into the Mellon Bank. Arthur Braun was the trustee for an estate, I think it was the Givens estate, that owned the Morning Post and the Evening Sun, and the Sunday Post at that time. In fact, someone sent me a postcard the other day, who collects old postcards. And this is a picture of the post building, which used to be on Wood and Liberty, just as you got to the end of Wood as it joined Liberty. It was very close to there. You may remember old Kramer's restaurant.
Oh, that I remember.
Well, this was sort of across the way from Kramer's on Wood Street. And an interesting postcard, because Pittsburgh was spelt without an H at that time. You know, there was a period when Pittsburgh was not spelled with an H.
No, I didn't know that.
And I must research what that period is, because it would give us an idea of when this postcard was printed.
Yeah.
Yes.
And when I first came to Pittsburgh in 1937 to work at the Post Gazette, mostly in connection with the building we were building at 2nd and Grant, which is now, you know, the public safety building, that was where I worked at Wooden Liberty. And it was an old plant, and it had a couple of basements, and there was a lot of equipment there. And in the flood of 36, why, of course, that was all flooded, and they couldn't print there. They had to go up to Newcastle, and then I think to Youngstown to print the paper.
I remember that flood.
Oh, yeah.
But the paper did come out? It was printed there?
Oh, yes, the paper came out. It was printed in Newcastle one night, and I don't know whether we were able to print all the papers, you know, because those are small papers, and I don't know how much they were able to produce, but we printed, and then we went to Youngstown. I guess we printed a full run there. But it took some time after the flood receded to clean out those basements and get that equipment operating again. Mm-hmm. So I think we were probably out of there 5 or 6 days, maybe more. Again, that's something I would have to research. I don't remember the exact figures on that.
Mr. Hearst, of course, was very much involved. Hearst Papers. Was there much of his influence on the Post-Gazette?
No particular influence on the Post-Gazette, no. My father ran the Post-Gazette. Now, it's true that my father ran some front page editorials, signed editorials, and it may be that he got that idea from Mr. Hearst, because Hearst did some of that too. But I don't think that Hearst had any particular influence on the editorial policy. As a matter of fact, in 1932, Hearst was for Roosevelt. The Hearst papers were for Roosevelt, I'm quite sure. And my father, of course, was a Rock Rib Republican from upper New York State. And he had gotten to know Herbert Hoover, and he supported Hoover. And he did the same in 36. And I don't know whether Hearst had become disenchanted with Roosevelt by 36. I think he was opposed to Roosevelt in 36. And in 40, of course, a lot of publishers were opposed to the third term idea. And I think that Roosevelt did us a grave injustice in running for a third term. That's been a very bad thing for this country, because by running for a third term and then again on a fourth term when he was a very sick man, the next time the Republicans were in power, they started this amendment to limit the terms to two. Well, you see, that means that in your second term as president, you've lost your power. They know you can't be reelected. Whereas in the old tradition, where it was two terms, but there was always the chance that someone would run a third term, you kept some of that power at least.
It would have had an effective second term.
And you need the president to have some power, otherwise the Congress is predominant. And you need that balance. You need the president to have some real power. And now it's pretty much your first term. It's make or break in the first term.
Mr. Black, I just finished reading the Catherine Graham story.
Oh.
And Hearst seemed to have a tremendous influence on that family.
On the Graham family. I didn't know that.
Yeah.
Well, they bought, didn't they buy the Times Herald from
Hearst?
Well, I thought it was Sissy Patterson, but she, Hearst had some part in that.
Yes.
I knew Phil Graham very well before he went off the deep end and went really out of his mind. I mean, some of the things
must
that...
Must have been a brilliant man.
He was very bright. He was very bright. He kept very odd hours. Call you midnight, 1 a.m. I can't keep those hours. But he was a very bright man. And
did you know Catherine's father, Myers?
Yes, Eugene Meyer.
Eugene Meyer.
I knew him, not well, but I had met him, and I was at his home once. At Phil Graham's invitation, there was a meeting there. It was a meeting where General Marshall, who was then Secretary of State, and Chip Boland and George Kennan and a lot of people were there, and they were about to go to a meeting with the Russians. They had invited a lot of publishers and editors, and Phil invited me because I was very young and kind of wet behind the ears, but I went to the meeting, and I sat in the back of the room, and unfortunately at the very back. And I was next to the bar, and a couple of the editors who were sitting in the front row were constantly sending their glasses back to be filled. One of them was Roy Roberts, the editor of the Kansas City Star, who had a great deal of power in the Middle West. And the other was Paul Bellamy of the Cleveland Plain Dealer. And I must say that they got a little drunk, and I thought embarrassed us, but maybe I was super critical, but I didn't like the idea of a couple of, here were our top leadership, not the president, but all of the top leadership of State Department, coming to get, theoretically at least, to get some advice, not really. And Eugene Meyer playing host to them, and for a couple of editors to get drunk. And then Roy Roberts got up when he was asked for comments and said, well, don't get us in any kind of a war just to re-elect Truman, which I thought was the most embarrassing thing I'd ever heard anybody say. I looked around to see whether I could find a hole in the rug to disappear in. It was so, to me, very embarrassing. But anyway, so the other memory I have of Eugene Meyer was when Senator McCarthy appeared before the American Society of Newspaper Editors, and I was sitting right in back of Mr. Meyer, and he couldn't hear too well. So when McCarthy started to speak, he leaned forward and cupped his ear like this. And then I could see the red coming up his collar. He was getting so angry, and the blood rising. And then suddenly he'd uncup his ear and sit back. And he didn't want to hear any more right away. And then he'd lean forward again and cup his ear. And, you know, I knew how he felt because McCarthy just irritated me no end. And with all of this phony alleged proof of how many communists there were in the State Department.
Alleged patriotism.
And he, you know, he came in with big piles of paper which he put on a table, never referred to or anything, but it's
impressive.
It's his fake documentation, or at least his alleged documentation of his charges. So anyway, at the end of his speech, the sh- shock to me was that the editors of America who were there stood up and gave him a standing ovation. Not Meyer, not Block, and not a handful of others, but the great majority gave him a standing ovation. And that was the mood of that day.
I was going to ask, you may have seen me start to ask the question, did the newspapers take a stand?
Did the newspaper?
Yes.
Oh, the Post-Gazette? Oh,
yes.
Definitely. Oh, in those days we had lots of battles. You may not remember that Judge Musmano got in the act in condemning Roy Harris, who was a composer in residence at Chatham, and Johanna Harris was a pianist in residence, supported by the Mellon Educational and Charitable Trust. Matt Svedek, who had been an informer for the FBI and who had some months before, I don't know exactly when, appeared before the House Un-American Activities Committee and had spilled his guts and therefore was no longer of any value to the FBI. And therefore they stopped paying him. They had been paying him retainers of one sort or another for his information about what I wouldn't know in the Pittsburgh area. When the FBI dropped him, why then, of course, he started going around making speeches, trying to earn money that way. And of course, in order to earn money that way, you have to make strong accusations or sensational statements so that people want you to come and be a speaker. And he started to attack Roy Harris. And he attacked Harris because Harris had written a piece of music for a Soviet-American friendship meeting in New York in 1944 during the war, to which Churchill and Roosevelt and Eisenhower all sent words of greeting and encouragement of the meeting. And here they were condemning Harris because he wrote a piece of music for that meeting. Well, you know, it's amazing how these things build on it. Musmano then, Judge Musmano, who was ambitious to run for governor, seized upon the occasion to have the veterans of foreign wars, state veterans of foreign wars in Harrisburg, condemn Harris. Then he sought to get the American Legion in Allegheny County to condemn him. But there was a Colonel Schenkel, who was, I think, clerk of courts at that time, who was head of the American Legion. And he thought this was rather unfair. And for the first time, someone stood up to Musmano and wouldn't let the resolution go through to condemn, have the American Legion condemn Harris. But you know, the Mellon Educational Charitable Trust was so scared, they didn't know that much about Harris. So they hired Charles Kenworthy, who was the chief trial lawyer at Reed Smith Shaw and McClay. And Kenworthy had a firm in Washington do a complete research job on Harris from the time he was a boy. A very expensive job forced on them by this kind of attack. And what they found after all this research was that Roy Harris was apolitical. He just had never been interested in anything to do with politics. He was a composer. He was a musician. He was interested in music. He'd never taken political positions. He wasn't interested in that at all. But here he was being condemned.
Crucified.
You know, it was a strange period in our life, you know. I'm just reading, just started reading the book The 50s, which came out recently by a very good writer who wrote about Vietnam. And
David Halberstam? Was that David Halberstam?
Right. And he's written a book on the 50s, and I immediately turned to this period of the McCarthy. It's hard to believe that
it could happen.
That, you know, this, we get very, very emotional about these things. It was a strange period in this country's life when we were so frightened by communism that we, that everything, anything that had to do with communism was immediately considered subversive. And, you know, they pilloried so many people. All this attack about that General Marshall had lost China, and that all the people who advised Marshall, John Stuart Service and Davies and various others who were involved anybody who was considered an expert on China was immediately pilloried because we, the U.S., lost China as if we could control what a billion people does. It was heartrending.
My husband worked for Westinghouse, and some of his colleagues lost their jobs because they wouldn't pledge. But they had not. They were not communists,
no.
But they refused to have their rights infringed upon,
yeah,
and lost their jobs.
Yeah, there were a lot of people who suffered as a result of it. I suppose it's not unlike China today, where if you're considered too Western, you're pilloried.
In looking back on our notes, I note that you had promised to tell some stories about the Jews in Hotchkiss.
The what?
You had promised to tell some stories about the Jews in Hotchkiss when you were there.
Oh, well, I think that most of those Eastern prep schools were very, very sparing, it might be the word, or restrictive about admitting Jews. At the time that we went to school, I would say there were not more than a handful in a school of 350 students, I think, something of that nature. It might have been a half a dozen or so. And but that was common, I think, at that period. When I went to Yale, nobody of the Jewish faith was admitted to any fraternity that I know of, and of course the secret societies were very exclusive, still are, I suppose, although I think there's been a rebellion and women are now at the but
I don't know what you had in mind, but you said, remind me to tell you some stories about that.
About
the Jews at Hotchkiss. And I don't know what you had in mind when you said that.
No, I don't think that I had anything very special in mind about that. Recently, there was a rhubarb there. Well, I don't know that it was a rhubarb, but recently there was an objection by a group of the Jewish students that in the chapel there was always a cross in the chapel. There was some objection. There was some objection. I believe there's now a Hillel branch there, so you can see that there's been a
considerable long way.
And my memory is about this that there was some complaint about the use of the cross all the time. And I think that the headmaster in studying this, and he was a professor of religion at Dartmouth before he became the head of Hotchkiss, so he is sensitive to this sort of thing. I think that he agreed to remove it for certain times, not always, but at certain times. Whereupon a classmate of mine, who will go unnamed.
End of tape 3, side 1, to be continued.
He wrote a ringing denunciation